Hello, 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 Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York, and WOOS 98.9 FM, Schenectady, broadcasting live from the Sanctuary for Independent Media. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm your other host, Alexis Goldsmith. Today we hear from Melissa Bromley speaking with people at the Extinction Rebellion protest that happened in New York City yesterday.
Then we'll hear from the Triple E segment from Lou Wilton, the firewood guy.
And later on, we'll hear from Willie Terry at the Environmental and Climate Justice from Puerto Rico to Albany Forum on Saturday, April 13th.
After that, the 12th segment in Imani, My Right Arm Tailors Technology Series.
And finally, Camden Adore talks about the transgender service ban. But first, let's start the show off with some headlines, Bosch.
Okay, I knew you adored me. The city of Troy is taking bids from qualified contractors to demolish the former Leonard Hospital. Mayor Patrick Manning announced plans to remove the building located at 74 Turnpike Road on Collar City's historic Lansingburg neighborhood by October 1st of this year. Originally constructed in the 1960s, the abandoned medical facility will also require asbestos removal prior to demolition. Leonard Hospital closed its doors over 20 years ago. The approximately 6.4-acre site is targeted for redevelopment as a shovel-ready project following the completion of demolition later this year. Copies of Leonard Hospital demolition and asbestos abatement services bids can be obtained from the City of Troy's Purchasing Department, 433 River Street, Troy, New York, 12180. Interested vendors can request electronic documents from Claudia Mahoney and Claudia Mahoney@TroyNewYork.gov. Responses are due by May 15th, 2019 at 11 a.m.
That's Claudia.Mahoney. You gotta have the dot in there. Okay, just for clarification. If there's any contractors out there that want to bid for this, every day should be Earth Day, but April 22nd is the annual day that we celebrate. And Troy has an annual event held to demonstrate public support for environmental protection and preservation. First launched in the United States in 1970, Earth Day is celebrated worldwide with more than 193 countries participating. So each year, the City of Troy sponsors a citywide cleanup event coinciding with Earth Day, and this community event brings together residents, families, and business owners to improve community parks, green spaces, and neighborhoods across the city. You can find the cleanup project schedule at troyny.gov/community/earth-day. That's troyny.gov/community/earth-day. And for more information on Troy's annual Earth Day cleanup or to organize a project cleanup in your neighborhood, please contact Renee Panetta, City Recycling Coordinator, at 518-279-7171.
I'm glad you got that dot, Alexis.
I've sent so many emails without a dot, and the mailer daemon comes back undelivered.
Oh, I can totally understand. Asylum seekers held in immigration detention in the Capital Region and those who cross into New York from Canada illegally could be held indefinitely under a new federal ruling. Attorney General William Barr, boy, wow, he's a piece of work, right? Released a decision Tuesday that says asylum seekers who pass credible fear interviews with immigration officers, the first step to prove they have fled prosecution or persecution in their home countries after entering the U.S. illegally, are ineligible to get bond while their asylum claims are being decided. by the immigration judge, the Department of Homeland Security can still decide to grant parole bans. Policies will be effective in 90 days.
You know, Vash, I just find it interesting that they use prosecutorial language for asylum seekers like bond and parole.
How about that?
It's, you know, it's interesting. So Albany will replace its streetlights with new energy efficient LED fixtures under programs by the State Public Service Commission and New York Power Authority. By buying and upgrading 10,800 streetlights, the city will reduce energy consumption and electricity costs by more than $3 million a year and cut greenhouse gas emissions equivalent to about 600 cars every year. The state has a program to upgrade about 500,000 municipal streetlights by 2025.
That's a good, good project. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
And to learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, please email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Yesterday in New York City, 62 activists with Extinction Rebellion were arrested after shutting down traffic and staging a die-in outside City Hall, including several activists from the Capital Region and Troy especially. The demonstrators partially blocked access to the Brooklyn Bridge, lying down in the street and scaling stoplights to demand radical action on climate change. In this piece, you'll hear from a variety of demonstrators shortly before they were arrested.
What's your name and why are you here?
Hi, my name is Dr. Susan Rubin, and I am here risking arrest today with Extinction Rebellion because we need to wake people up about the seriousness about climate disruption.
How did you find out about this event?
Well, I've been following all sorts of green groups probably for more than a decade, and when I saw that Extinction Rebellion was very organized in the UK, when they came here to New York, I got involved, started attending meetings, going to potlucks, and they're a good group.
And what do you hope will be the outcome of today's action?
I hope today's outcome will cause Mayor de Blasio to actually start to take action, declare a climate emergency. And I also hope that all the other green groups that are around watching will join us in the future.
Thank you. So what's your name and why are you here today?
My name is Diane Moxley, and I am here because we are getting close to the point of no return, in which climate chaos will be irreversible. So we are here today to demand immediate system change to fight our climate chaos that is imminent.
What are you hoping will be the results of today's action?
We're trying to wake up the people so they can join us at future actions. But most importantly, we're trying to wake up the government to take immediate action.
What is an example of immediate action that you would hope to see?
Well, some of our demands are that the government start telling the truth in regards to climate change. We are also demanding a plan to immediately, it's actually for 2025 to get off fossil fuels, but we need a plan of renewable energy now.
Is there anything else that you want to say that I haven't asked you about?
No, just that I hope that people come out and join us at future actions. If you look at on Facebook, Extinction Rebellion NYC and Extinction Rebellion, this is a week of action, so check out your hometown Extinction Rebellion and please come out and join us because our government isn't going to act unless the people act and demand system change now.
What's your name and why are you here today?
My name is UDA Collins, and I am here today for many reasons, but mainly probably because I can. I don't have to be at work this morning, and I have the privilege where I'm in a situation that I can get arrested. So I feel like I should.
What are you hoping are some of the results from today's action?
I think it would be great, obviously, if the movement got bigger. I was looking at photos from the other actions around the world with XR, and a lot of the photos were really captivating and eye-catching and really inspiring, and I'm hoping that, you know, we jump on that and continue that and help that grow, and hopefully more people join and get arrested again.
What is it about climate change that has you taking action?
I feel like climate change is just something that nobody is going to be able to escape. I think, unfortunately, the poor will be affected first, which is unfair because their carbon footprint is the smallest compared to the rich and elite. But it's eventually going to affect everybody and everyone's children and their children. So it just seemed like the most urgent issue to tackle.
What's your name and why are you here?
My name's Bill Beckler, and I'm here because I feel like it's absolutely necessary to do something extraordinary to change the way that our society is handling climate change.
What are you hoping will be the consequences of today's action?
Well, we're hoping to get dozens and dozens of people arrested. And when lots of ordinary people are getting arrested, other people see that and they hopefully will start to think, maybe this is an emergency. Maybe this is not just the usual kind of protest.
What brought you here today?
Well, this week is kind of special. In London, they're going through an extremely large, continually escalating protest to kind of shut down the capital city of the UK to force the government to talk about their demands. We're timing our protests alongside the London protests, and we have the exact same demand, which is the government needs to declare an emergency.
What's your name and why are you here today?
My name is John Keller, and I'm here because I'm scared. I'm 67, so the end of my life is closer than it's ever been. And I think, you know, it makes me think about the end of everyone's life. You know, it's and I wish more people would think about that. But, you know, you can't. I mean, you see young people pushing baby carriages out in the street. They go, oh, yeah, they're immortal. And I know I'm not. And I believe in science. And we're being told that we're not immortal. And, you know, even Attenborough and Planet Earth says we're not. So it's like, must be true.
What are you hoping will be the results of today's action?
To galvanize people, to further persuade people to take climate change seriously.
Okay.
That was Melissa Bromley at the Extinction Rebellion protest in New York City yesterday. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
All right, my next guest on the Triple E segments will be Lou Wilton of Lou Wilton's Gourmet Firewood, exit 15 in off the Northway. Lou talks about his business of 30 years and how he makes a difference in providing energy to the North Country. Hello again, everyone. This is H. Bosch Jr. of the Triple E segment, Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship. Today's guest is Lou the Firewood Guy. And we have the, honor and pleasure to catch up with Lou. He's located at exit 15N off the Northway in Saratoga. So I'm going to dig right in to the interview. What is your name and where are you located?
Well, I'm Lou the Firewood Guy Furon. I'm located in the town of Wilton, but the address is exit 15N of the Northway. From that Northway, we're 2 miles away, just past the Walmart and Friendly's in the mall. Got a great location here with a lot of direct Route 50 traffic.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. How long have you been making firewood for?
Well over 20 years. It's my last hurrah. I plan on being here for another 20 years. It's my dream, and I produce good firewood to about 4,000 customers, 52 area restaurants, and a couple of cooking show personalities that I'm not allowed to mention.
I totally understand.
For obvious reasons.
But hopefully one day they'll get this interview, WOOC 105.3 FM,
yeah,
Troy,
yeah.
New York, yeah. The sanctuary for independent media, and they'll be able to listen.
There you go.
So how has making firewood impacted your life?
Well, it certainly gives me some discipline. My day starts at about 4 a.m., and I work it right through to, I'm exhausted, around 9 to 11 p.m.
Wow, long day.
7 days a week, mm-hmm. 365 days a year. My last day off was June 28th, 2017.
Wow.
And we put a brutal schedule in.
Mm-hmm.
Winter's more intense than the summers, but summers are very busy with the cooking shows that we host, the restaurants we produce wood for.
Do you have staff that help?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
And it's cyclical and seasonal, in the winter more than summer.
Okay. Yeah. Peak season, how many people do you employ? Because that means you're really making a difference.
Up to 18 in this respect. We have vendors that produce the wood out in the forest and bring it in for us here. Mm-hmm. So they're not really
all in the Adirondack area.
Adirondack firewood. I just have the best quality Adirondack firewood. Never anything out of an orchard. Orchard wood, like cherry or orchard apple, full of poisonous spray. You don't want to burn it, to cook with it, or even to smell it. It's not good.
Dangerous.
For you.
Dangerous.
It is.
So I hear you are somewhat of a carpenter aficionado. What made you get into that?
Well, we in the firewood business, you deal with a lot of wood and a lot of logs. And I saw logs that were just too beautiful to harvest in the firewood. So we take them to a mill and have them sawn into very rustic tabletops, countertops, bar tops, mantles for fireplaces. We do a lot of work for weddings where they take these, we call them cookies, they're round discs like a checker, but big, 8, 10, 12, 14 inches in diameter. And the weddings use those as table settings for their plates on top of the wooden dishes. Cherry's wonderful for that. It's a beautiful color to cherry. Wild red cherry is just outstanding when it's there on a nice white tablecloth.
Great.
With the flowers, the cookies, or the cake, and everything on it.
So how has your gift of making firewood made a difference in the community?
Well, first of all, we are eye candy. When people go by here, you'll hear people blow the horn.
I like that, I love bonfires.
Yeah. Well, it's eye candy where we have all these wooden carvings, chainsaw carvings, funky little situations where we just put up a huge dream catcher out there, 5 foot in diameter, hanging out over Route 50. We're getting a lot of thumbs up online over that. We have a website, of course, and we're on Facebook, and people comment all the while. If you get onto our Facebook comments, you're going to find out that 99.9% of them all are thumbs up, and they're very happy with our service.
Well, that's what we're going to close out with. I want you to let people know how they can reach you. So in the meantime, let me move to my next question. Do you have any plans for the future that are significant?
Yeah, I'm going to be right here for the rest of my life. That's my plans.
Great plan. Yeah. Great plan. What are some of your goals for being right here for the rest of your life?
Well, stay healthy.
Amen.
This is my health club.
Right.
When my boy,
I'm sure you get plenty of exercise
every
doing
day.
This.
Every day. Whether sawing wood or stacking wood, we call it piling wood, or raking the grounds or driving the trucks. My days are never boring. They just always fly by. Before you know it, it's dark, and I've got my bookkeeping to do at dark.
Mm-hmm.
9, 10, 11 o'clock
sun
at night.
Sun up to sundown.
It's every day, 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. We are here 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
So who's some of your biggest supporters in this business?
Well, supporters in the way of nice people like you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Always visited by the newspapers. You look on our walls, and you'll see that write-ups by Times Union, Schenectady Gazette, Saratogian.
Oh, wow.
Spectrum comes in here once a year and does a documentary. Nice people like you, of course. Now, this is a new territory for me, but you're always welcome. I get a lot of support from from my customers. They always are saying very nice things about me online, and that's my applause.
I believe a good reference is the highest form of a compliment.
Well, I agree with that.
Yes. So where'd you go to school at, and who were some of your role models?
I was educated at Colony Central High School in Colony, New York. Bosh, you know that one, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, right.
Yep. I have family that attended Colony High School.
Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah, I did it many years ago. I was the first complete graduating class when we moved into the high school. It was brand new. I had a short stint with Albany Business College.
Okay.
Great little story. I was told by my professor that I should save my parents' money and not go to college. And it's real good.
Well, look what happened, you know.
This is good.
Mm-hmm.
My professor agreed with the dean. I went into the business world, and in 4 years, the professor was working for me doing my accounting.
So let me end that particular question with, I am a firm believer, and I get in a lot of hot water when I say this, but because I believe in a formal education, and I promote that first and foremost, but college may not be for everyone, but making money is, Lou. Am I right or wrong?
I like that. Amen. Amen.
Yes. You know, I'll say that again. College may not be for everyone, but making money is, and you've did quite well for yourself. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Yep. And that is where I'm going to lead into my next question. What were some of your hobbies growing up as a kid?
Well, I lived in a residential area, Bosch, but it was near a forest. And most of my day, when I wasn't in school or home doing my chores, was in the woods. I was either hunting or fishing or building forts or just hiking and bird watching. I'm just an outdoor naturalist. I love the outdoors.
Gun lover.
Gun lover. Gun respecter.
Ah, I like that. Yep. Gun respecter.
Yep.
Right. Because there's gun users and there's gun abusers.
Yep.
Right. And I definitely appreciate that. So before we end, is there anything else we should know about you, Lou?
Well, that I'm here 24 hours a day, ready for some more customers. We have 4,000 now, and we can certainly use more.
Okay.
We're here 24/7 at exit15n.com. Check
me
out.
And I'm going to promote you like the Gospel of Luke, all right, when I'm done. So now I want you to close out, tell everyone how they can reach you and all the social media, everything.
Well, we have a great Facebook.
What's that?
Exit15n.com is the website, and from there we'll lead you right to the Facebook. Facebook comments are always glowing. It's my applause. I work very hard to get compliments, and when I do get them, they're cherished.
They're cherished.
Yeah, they are.
Uh-huh. Okay. And Facebook, how about you said Facebook? Was there any other
website? Is exit15n.com.
Exit15, yep.
You get on that.
And Lou the Firewood.
Lou the Firewood guy.
Okay. Yeah. Now, real quick, there was another question I asked. I understand you are an available bachelor, right? That's on fire, hit firewood.
That's cute. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Okay, all right. Well, listen, all my listeners and Made to Believe LLC Network, Lou the Firewood guy, exit 15 North, going up the Northway right past Saratoga, is an eligible, willing, and able, healthy bachelor.
Yeah, it's true.
We appreciate your time. We appreciate you finally letting us catch up with you. I know you've been busy, and you've been so grateful and kind to carve out some room in your schedule for us to come up and do this interview. And don't be a stranger. All right?
Thanks, Bosch.
Yeah, really, you're a part.
Pleasure meeting you.
Okay, and I know you got to go, and I'm going to close out. Until next time, folks, it's about the triple E's: education, empowerment, entrepreneurship. And remember this, don't hear about making a difference. You need to be about making a difference. This is Inez's Bosch's baby boy, H. Bosch Jr., doing what I'm made to believe. Okay. That was Lou, the Firewood guy. Exit 15 and off the Northway. Thank you so much, Lou, for really educating us on a family-owned business that has been in business for over 30 years. We appreciate you.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
And I'm H. Bosch Jr. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio.
You know you want to learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, so to listen online and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out at mediasanctuary.org. And if you have comments, suggestions, or fan mail, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And don't forget to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region. The Hudson Mohawk Network roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry attended the Environmental and Climate Justice from Puerto Rico to Albany Forum on Saturday, April 11th at the Capital District Latino Center at 160 Central Avenue, Albany. In this segment, you'll hear part one of his interviews with panelist speakers from the forum, Natalie Pena, Felice, Quinones Nieves, and Merton Simpson. Not close enough. Got to have respect. And Merton Simpson.
This is Willie Terry, WOOC, Roman Labor Correspondent, and I'm here at the Environmental and Climate Justice from Puerto Rico to Albany Forum at the Latino Community Center. And I have one of the speakers that I'm going to talk to just for a couple of minutes, and her name is Natalie Pena, right? And she's a student, climate strike leader, and activist. And I know you gave a presentation up there, and I just want to ask you, what were some of the key points that you were trying to bring out in your presentation?
So some of the key points that I was trying to bring out in my presentation is just that climate change is a growing issue that affects people as well as the environment. And for a lot of students who aren't old enough yet to vote or old enough yet to support candidates that support their views on climate, striking out is a really good way to let our voices be heard because we're able to be represented. And it really sends a statement when you have millions of students worldwide leaving school to stand up for something common they believe in.
Now, tell me something about yourself and your organization. And how you got involved in it?
So I really got involved when I saw that there was a climate strike happening in Albany. And I saw that nobody else from my school was really trying to organize anything as of right then and there.
What school was it?
Oh, Albany High School. And I saw that nobody else was really, they were interested, but they weren't going out of their way to organize it and make it a school-wide thing. So I decided to bring that upon myself and organize a climate strike for the entire school. And we had a couple hundred students walk out, which is way more than I expected because it happened actually within, everything happened within a week of the strike, all of our outreach to administrators and things like that. So we had a lot of students walk out, and that's really how I got involved. And then from there on out, I just began to get involved with organizations like This Is Zero Hour, which helps organize strikes as well, and also talks about climate change's impact on people and environmental justice. And from here on out, I just try to do a lot of community education and teaching people like how we can help fix climate change and what it is and how it affects them.
And I noticed you talked about youth. What message would you have for students and youth in terms of getting involved in this issue?
So for students and youth in terms of getting involved in climate change issues and climate activism is just don't let people stop you from trying to achieve what you want to. Because a lot of people are willing to put youth down because we're youth and we're not expected to know as much as adults are, but in reality some of us know as much or even more about the topic as adults do. You can't let people beat you down because they think they know more than you do. And also, just you don't have to take no for an answer in terms of all of this, because it's such an important issue that while you shouldn't go out of your way to be completely disobedient and go against every grain that there is, it is okay to go against the grain to work for such an important issue like this one.
All right. Thank you, Jenna.
Oh, thank you.
All right. And I have another one of the speakers here at the forum.
My name is Felix Quinones Nieves.
Yes, okay. And Felix, you're with the Center for Human Service and Research at the University of Albany?
Yes, that's correct.
Oh, okay. Now, I just want to ask you, what was some of the key points that you was trying to raise in your presentation today?
Today, I was talking about the effect of the Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, and like that needs to be with climate change specifically, and how the environmental racism or the environmental changes affect what we're seeing today after the effects of Maria. Some of the numbers that we were presenting were related to the percent of people without electricity, power, or fuel after the hurricane, and the economic impact of the Hurricane Maria, and how much time, how many years will Puerto Rico need to possible average all the effects of the hurricane and get back to their situation of their best years, like 2006.
Yeah. So, Phil, do you have family there?
Yeah, all my family live in Puerto Rico. I'm a student from the SUNY Albany right now, and I moved 5 years ago from Puerto Rico to possibly complete my PhD at the University of Albany, but all my family live there. Yeah.
And how were they impacted by the...
I have uncles that lost their houses. I have family that continue struggling without... that they have electricity some days that don't have electricity. It continue being really hard in the area of employment and other areas of health issues specifically. Many doctors or many hospital facilities close after a hurricane, and they are not opening anymore, or the services are not as fast services or a better services that they were before.
Now, people listen to this broadcast right here. Yep. What would you want to say to people in order to let them know how important it is for them to get involved in this situation?
That the environmental changes affect everyone in every single place. Whatever we are doing here in New York, in Albany, in the Capital District, will not only affect us here, will affect us in every part of the world. If we contribute a little bit here to enhance, to have a better environmental policies, that will create a ripple effect in other parts of the world. And we need to be conscious of that. It's like the hurricane affect Puerto Rico and the people that live in Puerto Rico, but the changes and the problems that we have in the South End affect all of us in Albany. And we need to be aware of it. It's not only a fight of the South End or a fight of the people that live in there. It's a fight that we all need to fight, being conscious that whatever we do affect us in every single area.
All right. Thank you, Felix, and keep up the fight.
Thank you.
And I'm here with one of the speakers, Mert Simpson, who's an Albany County legislator. And Mert, how you doing?
Good, good.
All right, Mert, tell me, what was the key points that you were trying to bring out in your presentation?
Well, everybody needs to support all of the positive legislation on environmental justice. Right now, there's an Environmental Bill of Rights. There's a community bill on climate protection that needs to be supported. And then, of course, we need to have support for the Green New Deal. But all these things are coming together at once, and it takes citizen action, people, to make it really happen. All of the presidential candidates are talking about climate issues. We need to get that in a statewide level, have the positive legislation that's in effect be passed.
So what's happening on the county legislative area around climate?
Well, Cher in the vanguard of trying to lead the statewide environmental initiative. We're using Sheridan Hollow part of a base, and we're actually part of a global network that's going to use the Sheridan Hollow proposed microgrid as an example of environmental racism on a worldwide scale. And that will also put pressure on the governor, along with the consciousness on the presidential cycle for environmental change. But the governor is still moving too slow. We got him to change some language in the budget around Sheridan Hollow to lean towards renewable energy. But we have to go much further than that. There's still all kinds of fossil fuel plants. There's this whole problem with a natural gas pipeline going through Rensselaer. That shouldn't be.
Now, Sheridan Hollow, that's a bill or that's an organization?
No, there's an organization called the Sheridan Hollow Alliance for Renewable Energy that I'm the co-chair of. And our focus is the specific facility at 79 Sheridan Avenue, but it's also plugged into a statewide and a national focus because the Sheridan Hollow plant actually fuels the whole 98-acre Empire State Plaza. And what we're saying is most people in the country live in either New York State or California. So what we want is the money that's been devoted for the proposed natural gas power plant to be used for renewable energy, so that could be a model for the whole country as what could be done specifically with geothermal energy.
Okay. And you did mention something about our illustrious president.
Oh, well, he's a big problem. I mean, he's had a head of EPA that's against, you know, fighting the global climate change. He's just retrograde all the way. And what I'm afraid is right now, if the Democrats don't get their act together, he'll still be in there again. And I don't know if the planet can survive four more years of Agent Orange.
All right. Thanks, Lord.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
All right.
That was Mr. Willie Terry at the Environmental and Climate Justice from Puerto Rico to Albany Forum on Saturday, April 13th.
And now live in the studio, Des Moines joins our engineer, Imani Taylor, to continue her series on technology and its impacts on different generations.
Can I say something? Hey, how you doing, man?
I'm pretty good.
Welcome back. How's life treating you?
I'm pretty good. It's been interesting,
okay,
and fun and all those good things.
Okay. Well, let's dig right in. Okay. Here we go.
Thanks for being here, Des Moines.
No problem at all.
So tell for those who don't know, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm Des Moines. I've worked in technology for a very long time now.
Do you know how to cut and paste?
I just figured that out yesterday.
All right. Don't be intimidated. I can teach you if you don't. No.
Do you mind sharing how old you are?
I am 28.
And would you say that you grew up in the computer era, whatever that means to you?
Yes, I would.
What does that mean to you?
Well, I think I can remember when AOL was sending out those CDs that you had to have to connect to the internet back in the day when you just had dial-up. You know, put it in your computer.
Absolutely. Dinosaurs.
Yeah, put it in your computer, you know, hear.
And you hear the phone ring.
Right. Right. Everybody had a fax machine back then.
Yeah, right.
So how old were you when you got your first cell phone?
Oh, when I got my first cell phone, I was about 16 or 17.
And what kind of phone was it?
Sidekick.
I don't even know what that is.
Yeah. T-Mobile Sidekick. It flipped up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was amazing.
And what did you use it for then?
Well, 16, 17, I guess I was a sophomore, junior in high school. So whatever debauchery kids that age can get into.
So you don't remember the cell phones in my era. They were like small refrigerators.
Oh.
You know, they were so big. And roaming charges were like $99.95, you know, per minute. If you
I love the car phone.
Right.
And it's a briefcase.
Package. Yeah, with the briefcase. It was almost like the football. Like you had this nuclear code you would carry around with you. And you would get bills like $700, $800, $1,500 in roaming charges.
Back in my bail days, before the breakup.
Right. But I'll let Imani continue, you know.
So my next question usually would be, do you have a phone now? Is it a smartphone? But I know the answer to this. I know you have about 5 smartphones and like 5 laptops. So I want to know, how do you use those devices differently now from when you first started using them?
Well, when I first started using cell phones, there wasn't much of an app store or anything like that. The tracking on phones definitely wasn't as extensive as it is now. And so it's really important to keep that in mind for me while I'm working with clients in different industries and protecting data, keeping data separated for different consulting and fun stuff.
Okay. What did you study in school?
I went to school for communications research and psychology.
Did you use a computer?
Yeah. A lot of papers. I think the shortest paper I ever had to write in college was 15 pages.
So how did you go from studying a very non-technical area to such a technical area?
Oh, well, growing up in the computer age, pretty much most of us learned about computers not from school, but from breaking and fixing stuff that you broke. Mm-hmm. And so when you break stuff enough and you fix it enough, you learn how to do it just like, let's say, a HVAC contractor back in the 1900s, right? There wasn't really a regulation or real training that you had to do. You know, you just find out how to break it and how to fix it, you know?
I guess, but I mean, I'm in college now, and I'm literally, this is literally what I'm studying. I'm a computer science major, and you didn't study this at all, and you know 10 times more than I do, and I learn so much about technology from you on a daily basis. So you must have been drawn towards it more than others in your class, per se.
I would say gravity works in the world differently for different people. So I was drawn to technology and breaking things. It's probably the easiest things I could fix. And so there's people that are drawn to other things that they can fix even easier, like H. Bosch and fixing the airwaves.
How about that?
So you learned just by breaking stuff. Nobody taught you. You had no one in your life who was exposed you to this at all?
I did not have a teacher. I had an uncle that worked in technology for a very long time, but there was no real passing of the torch, so to say.
Well, that's very admirable that you've acquired so much knowledge on your own. So overall, how would you say technology has impacted your life?
Well, I would say technology has impacted my life. It's made my life pretty good, but it's also made my life, like so many others, very scary from the ability of the government to track you, to stalkers tracking you, to...
That cut and paste part can be really, really traumatic. Absolutely overwhelming. I just want to throw that out there.
Especially when you highlight everything by mistake.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
What about social media? Are you on social media and how do you feel about it?
I am not on any of the mainstream social medias, as people would say. So Facebook, Twitter, Instagram.
Why not? Having the business that you have, which depends on technology.
I only work with technology vendors that I can trust. And so...
In fact, you create your own, is that right?
Yes, most of the technology services, like most people use Dropbox. I have my own variation of Dropbox that I use. Mm-hmm.
For those listening, I want you to know, this man has coded every mainstream site that you know of, he's coded his own safer, more secure, more private version of it, and that's what he uses. And he has no education in this field. I just want to make that clear. That is pretty remarkable.
Okay, Imani, but I've done some things around cutting papers. He's not the biggest guy on the block. But anyway, seriously. So why is it you withdraw from the current methods of social media today? Give us the reason behind that. So many people are attracted to that.
Yeah, it would have to be a mix in between the sense of community. Back in, I'll probably get the date wrong, but I would say around 2008 in the Facebook years, a lot of people, especially technologists, moved away from Facebook and things like that because we saw the direction that it was going in, and that was the birth of federated services, federated services are social media networks that you can use without any center or central point or control of it. And so you can have somebody that uses one website and another person that uses another website, and they can communicate with each other like email, but in a social media sense. So you get a Twitter or a Facebook-like interface, but there's no one control. Facebook has control over what happens on Facebook. You know, you have statuses getting taken down or blocked. I think right now about 7% of your followers see any one post you put out there, where most people actually believe that when they put a post out there that all of their followers are able
to see
it.
Why is that? And I might be one of the ones who believe that. Why is that, Des Moines?
This the changing of the algorithm and trying to foster more community and showing people more information that they might not know is out there. It's pretty much trying to predict what you are interested in.
Right.
And in any system trying to predict what people are interested in, there's downfalls.
I hate to cut this off, but we have a 15-minute segment coming up, and we have 15 minutes left of the show. So thank you so much for providing that insight, though.
Right. And we got to have him back.
Yeah, hopefully you'll come back. So thank you, Dee.
I'm going to frame you. Okay.
Now we have part one of Chris Phelan's interview with Camden Ador on his experience as a trans person in the military during recent policy changes.
Good evening. I'm Chris Phelan with the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, continuing our series on LGBTQ plus issues and resources. One of the biggest issues for the LGBTQ plus community in recent years has been what many are calling the transgender ban for military service. Since 2016, there have been a lot of changes and uncertainty about the inclusion of transgender service members, and tonight we have the opportunity to discuss it with our guest, Camden Ador, and his experience in the Navy. Camden is a 27-year-old trans person and visual artist. After serving in the U.S. Navy, he moved to New York City and is currently pursuing a degree in visual arts with a concentration in photography. Right now, his focus is in LGBTQ plus portraiture and exploring, through photography, the many facets of society's obsession with gender, but also to provide a source of education, showing that identity goes far beyond the binary. Welcome, Camden. I am so happy to talk with you tonight.
Hi. I am so happy to talk with you as well and excited that we get to discuss this ever-present topic.
So this is a super dense topic about a very important issue, so we're going to try to get through it as efficiently as possible. But let's begin with your military experience. When did you join?
I joined in 2012, and I got out in June of 2017. So almost a six-year term.
So you joined after Don't Ask, Don't Tell got repealed. And how did that affect your experience as a queer person in the military, coming out? Obviously, it's a little bit different with the transgender policies at the time.
Yeah, so what's kind of interesting about my story is when I joined in 2012, I actually identified as a lesbian. It wasn't until 2014 that I came out as transgender. And during that, you know, in between time, I was kind of thinking to myself on my identity, but I really hadn't told anybody. So when I first joined, I felt very blessed to have joined after the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. And so I can't really speak too much to the experience before that, but having talked to certain people, I know that it was a reality, even though there were some, you know, commanders and stuff who didn't necessarily put that as a priority. There were service members who made it a point to try and get those people out of the military. So I'm grateful that I never had to deal with that. And in terms of just people on the ship and everything like that, there was never any negativity towards my sexual identity.
Last month, we had the Trans Day of Visibility on March 31st. And on April 13th, the new policy, the transgender ban, is going to be going into effect. So when you joined in 2014, we were dealing with the previous policy before the Obama administration started to change the policy. This is the pre-26 policy where trans members weren't eligible for promotion. They needed to be treated according to their birth gender. They potentially could be discharged. And also, if there were new recruits that were openly trans, they were found unfit for duty. And additionally, there was no medical coverage. Members sought outside care and that came out of pocket. And when you came out in 2014, what was your experience adjusting with not only your fellow sailors on the ship, but also with the command? How did that work pre-2016?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question as well, because once I really realized I was trans, I started doing a lot of research in terms of trans military members. And what I found was that throughout the branches, there were particular doctors that were treating trans members on a case-by-case basis. So although the ban had not been lifted, there were still some doctors who were kind of going by what the civilian medical world was saying about trans patients and letting it happen. So when I came out, that was originally what I was wanting to try and do. So I spoke to my PCM on the ship. Initially, she was the first person in terms of the command that I came out to and let her know my issues. And she said that she would talk to some people to try and figure it out. But I don't know exactly what happened or where the disconnect was, and I don't know if it came from her or not. But this is just a crazy story to just explain how the training of individuals was just extremely lacking. So I had came to her and I had said that stuff about I'm trans and everything like that. And around this time, I was also going to be going on leave, and I had asked for my leave to be extended a couple more days. And somehow my department head found out that I wanted to extend my leave a couple more days and told the commanding officer that the reason I wanted to do that was so that I could undergo gender reassignment surgery, which was like so far from the truth. So unfortunately, I was so nervous by that happening, because he had told the commanding officer that, and the commanding officer had no idea that I was transgender. I felt that I needed to go to his office and speak to him immediately about the situation.
Right.
So I did, and I went and spoke to him. And at that point, I basically just said, okay, well, this is where I'm going to try and plead my case and see if he would be willing to talk to the doctors or allow me to start on hormones on a case-by-case basis like I had heard other people were doing. So I told him, and while he was very supportive of me being transgender and me taking on that identity and wanting to transition, he held firm in the current policy at the time, which stated that that wasn't something that we could do.
Right. So you definitely experienced how even the command or the medical staff had their hands tied, even though maybe there was some empathy for your situation. But then you also had this experience of kind of having a target on your back now that you're openly out, and that fear and anxiety that came along with it, knowing the current policy is definitely not supportive of you serving openly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Overall, in terms of the command, like the captain and my shipmates, I did have a positive experience in terms of coming out. However, there were just so many people that lacked so much education on the transgender identity and whatnot that they draw conclusions maybe or make assumptions that aren't true at all. And that was definitely something that I had to battle, not so much with my peers, but more so with the supervisors.
Then, in June 2016, Secretary of Defense Carter, under the Obama administration, announced that trans members would be able to serve openly. So this means no longer discharged or separated. And the RAND study that they did in ahead of this announcement was that there's estimates of about 7,000 active and 4,000 reserve members in the military who identify as transgender. And the point of this was that we want to be able to have the accession of all available talent in our all-volunteer force. He said, quote, "A matter of principle, Americans who want to serve and can meet our standards should be afforded to do so." Additionally, the RAND study showed that, quote, "there'd be a minimal readiness impact on the military." So after this June 2016 announcement, what changed? Did you, like, obviously this is a huge moment, almost akin to the repealing of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, in the sense of excitement and progress that was seeming to be made. But what changed for you? How did you feel? And going forward, was there any real progress?
Initially, when the announcement was made, I was very hopeful and very happy and just grateful, you know, that we were making progress in terms of, you know, equal rights and everything like that. But after it did officially go into effect, I again tried two more times to start getting on hormones. At this point, I had already been diagnosed by a psychologist, which the military was kind of following the standard that you needed to be diagnosed with gender dysphoria in order to be on hormones. However, in the civilian world, some doctors or insurance companies may require that, but a lot of people practice what's called informed consent. Mm-hmm. And so they basically talk to you about, you know, what's going on, what's going to happen with the hormonal changes and everything like that, and then you can go for it. So I tried multiple times and really just had no help at all. Like, nobody seemed to want to try and help me. And it's so much harder when you're on a smaller ship. I was on a destroyer. And on a destroyer, we actually don't have a licensed physician. We have a independent duty corpsman who is well-versed in terms of medical. However, if you need to do something, anything outside of the realm of, you know, everyday things, then you need to go to another doctor. But in order to go to another doctor when you're stationed on the ship, you need to get a referral from the corpsman, and it's nearly impossible to do.
Right,
because
you were
with anything.
You were forward deployed, right? So your deployment schedule is very busy, and without those resources, like you said, of an actual licensed physician available, in addition to the very high tempo of operations overseas with your multiple deployments, there's just a general lack of maybe access or real attention or real medical care for anyone, but especially someone in your shoes or trying to seek out this very specific medical care.
Yeah, I was forward deployed, so it was 4 months in, 4 months out, and I was also stationed in Spain. And honestly, at this time, I don't even know if, you know, there was, I think I actually remember them telling me that there was an endocrinologist. An endocrinologist is a hormone doctor and who you would see when you wanted to undergo hormone replacement therapy. I feel like I remember them telling me that there was an endocrinologist, but their patients are typically children. And so that's kind of how they wrote it off to me there.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So for those just joining us, I'm Chris Phelan with the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm speaking with Camden, who is a 27-year-old trans person and a visual artist who is also a veteran of the U.S. Navy. And we're discussing his experiences.
That was part one of Chris Phelan's interview with Camden Ador on his experience as trans person in the military during recent policy changes. Unfortunately, we had to cut that interview short, but you are welcome to listen to the interview in its entirety tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. and at 9 a.m. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Our engineer tonight is Imani Taylor. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. And you can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. And you can also listen to every individual segment we produce on that page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And also be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
We should have a segment on tender confessions.
Right.
Sounds nice. As a reminder, Hudson Mohawk Radio Network is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at infomediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings held right here Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. At the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr.